You're listening to The Drew Marshall Show, Canada's most listened to spiritual talkback program.
Well, he made it, folks. Dr. Bruce Wilkinson is in the house. Bruce has written over 60 books in 30 languages. Been number one in New York Times, number one in the Wall Street Journal, and number one in USA Today. His is the only book in history to win Book of the Year 2 years in a row. Publishers Weekly reported The Prayer of Jabez as the fastest-selling book of all time in 2001, and the only religious nonfiction to hit the number one New York Times bestseller list in the first week was A Life God Rewards. Whatever he touches turns into gold. Must be that Prayer of Jabez thing going on. He's also the New York Times best-selling author for children and teen books, the publisher and executive editor of 10 monthly magazines with over 120 million distributed. Good night. He is the author of The Prayer of Jabez, The Secrets of the Vine, A Life God Rewards, Beyond Jabez, Set Apart, Experiencing Spiritual Breakthroughs, and The Dream Giver. I'm out of breath. I don't know what else to say. Did you write any Hardy Boy books?
Did I write any Hardy books? No, I have not, but I certainly enjoyed them growing up.
They were good, weren't they?
They were good growing up.
Do you have to be a reader to be a writer? Is that key? You know, an avid, addicted reader to be a writer?
I don't think so. I think there's got to be something inside of you that is like a pressure that just keeps building and building. And you.
Oh, I got that.
You have the pressure?
It's called lactose intolerance, though.
I see.
Totally different thing.
I personally don't like to write.
You don't?
No.
Why?
I would much rather speak than write. I just spoke to the Promise Keepers event here.
Yeah.
6,500 men.
How'd that go?
I love that. Then yesterday was a pastor's conference. Love that. But writing is really hard work. I don't love to write. Writing, for me, is a method of getting the message to more people. And therefore, I go through the agony of it, because that's how I view it, to reach more people. That's the only reason I write. I don't say to myself, I wish I could write now.
No.
No, I don't.
But do you ever have those creative bursts where you just go, oh, I gotta get this out of my head and start writing?
Not very often, no.
Wow.
Surprising, isn't it?
Yeah.
66 books.
Hey, let's get the Prayer of Jabez stuff out of the way.
You okay? Can't get the Prayer of Jabez. It's here to stay. It's in the book.
Let's get it out of the way, okay? Because you've been interviewed about this thing a billion times. I'm holding my little hand. Something that I have...
One of the originals.
I don't know why I kept this. This is... Did you see this?
I did.
In the Sun. You know those tabloid magazines where they find aliens and people with two heads and all that kind of stuff?
And Jabez.
And Jabez, yeah. Right on the front. Shield of Jabez. This is The Sun, America's Best Love Weekly. Shield of Jabez. Harness its prayer power for money, health, and love. And what they're saying here is they've got a picture of a plaque, a silver plaque.
How long have you been saving this? I want to know this.
I've been dying to say this to you. The little plaque, and you cut out the little picture, and it says here, for money, place the shield over your lottery tickets for an entire day, and if you don't play the lottery, use a dollar bill. For love and a happy marriage, place the shield over your wedding ring. And if you're single and seeking, write down the characteristics you want your ideal partner to have and place the shield over the paper. And for health, sleep with the shield under your pillow or carry it in your pocket or purse. Its awesome power will protect you from all illness. Of course, on the shield is written the Prayer of Jabez.
Do you know when I saw that?
No.
I was in a grocery store in Florida at a convention with my daughter. And we're checking out, and she sees that magazine as we're going through the line. And she says, Dad, she was young back then, Dad, what's the Shield of Jabez? I said, sweetheart, I don't know. But, Dad, I thought you wrote the book. I did. And when I pulled that off, I, of course, sent off for it because I wanted, you know, to.
Oh, so you actually have to send away for
no,
it.
No, I'm only teasing you. I didn't send off for it.
Can you imagine that?
But everybody had their own approach to it.
They were just riding your coattails.
They were. But you know what? That's the way life is. It's okay.
Just how boring was the original book you wrote in 78, the 260-page zinger?
It was so boring, this is true, that I wouldn't let the publisher read it. When I was done, I read it again. I set it aside for a couple of weeks, and I read it again. And I said, this is so boring. I don't want any of my friends to read this. And I put it in the file. He was angry with me. And he said, I've heard you speak on this. It's dynamite. I said, I know, but when I wrote it down, it's not, it's dud. So for 1978, to the year 2000, it didn't go anywhere.
That's brutal.
It's amazing, isn't it, how God can do something at one level at one time, and then years later, when you've maybe grown into it, I don't know, he brings it back out and catches you by surprise, because he did.
What do you mean?
I had no desire to write a book on Jabez. I had failed with that. That was a failure. In fact, I had decided not to write another book because it wasn't reaching enough people for the agony I went through in writing. So I said to my wife, I said, sweetheart, it's too hard. I don't want to do it anymore.
Do you actually call your wife sweetheart?
I do.
Do you have any other little names you want to share with us?
Not with you here, no. So I said to her, I'm finished writing books. I'm not going to write anymore. And she said, well, I agree. It has been hard for you. So I was up in Oregon, and I was seeing some friends, and then and the publisher of Multnomah, Don Jacobson, who I taught his wife in college, he was talking to me, and I told him this. I said, I'm not writing any more books. It's too hard. So he talked, and he said, you know, maybe you need somebody to help you edit it. I said, Don, I don't want to do any more books. And he eventually talked me into doing one, and that was going to be it. And then one day, I was driving along on the freeways of Atlanta, and Dr. Dobson's wife called me on my cell phone. Now, that's never happened before or since. I'm driving along. Hi, Bruce. This is Shirley Dobson. This is who? Shirley Dobson. Shirley, you're kidding me. No. She said, Jim and I just got back from a road trip, and we listened to some tapes, and we listened to your sermon on the Prayer of Jabez. It really encouraged us. Would you consider coming back to Washington, D.C. to be the speaker for the National Day of Prayer and give Jabez? I started laughing and said, come on, you're kidding me. No. So I said, let me pray about it, and I'll tell you tomorrow. Agreed to it. A while went by, and I said to my wife, you know, all these people who are coming from all over the country to pray for the nation, maybe we should give them a thank you.
Oh, is this when you handed all those puppies out and no one said thanks back?
They didn't.
Like, that's just brutal. You handed out, what, how many?
Probably 600. So I said, you know, why don't I put it together and just give them out as a gift?
Yeah.
And they didn't come. So where did the banquet the night before, where there's judges and Congress and senators there, and there's 600 of us. And I'm going through the line with my wife. And lo, right behind, against the wall in the hotel, are these little boxes of books called The Prayer of Jabez. And I said, I can't believe it, they're here. I hadn't seen one. So I walk over sheepishly, you know, kind of a little bit embarrassed, opened it up, looked at it here, and I asked permission of the lady giving out the name tags. Can I give away one of these books?
Can I give away one of my books, please?
And she said, what is this? I said, it's a book I wrote. You want to give this away? Yes. You don't want to sell them? No. I just want to give them away. Well, okay. So I handed there with my wife, and we handed them out, and there wasn't one person who said anything. Not thank you, not anything.
That's awkward, eh?
I said to Darlene, never again. This was the biggest waste of time. And then what happened is, I got a call from the publisher a few weeks later, and he said, are you sending your friends to bookstores to buy the books? He actually called and asked me that. And I laughed, and I said, no, why are you asking me that? He said, the book is selling. I said, no, it's not. Who would ever go to the bookstore and ask for a name they've never heard of?
Hmm.
And I honestly believe that God, you know, this isn't a joke. I believe what happened is people of all religious backgrounds decided to test this thing kind of out of curiosity.
Hmm.
And then God would answer it. And they would be utterly shocked. And they would tell somebody else what God did. And I think God got more glory. And I think he turned to Michael and said, Michael, market the book. I honestly believe that's what happened. There's no human explanation for what happened.
Then you got rich.
I did.
Here's something. I want to talk about the money thing in a second, but here's something.
You want to talk about money?
Oh, I love talking about
money. You want to know what private names I have for my wife?
Yeah.
And then you want to talk about my money?
Oh, yeah.
Look at this.
Yeah.
Is there nothing sacred
here? There's nothing sacred here in this room at all, and it's about 110 degrees in here, so if you want to take off your jacket, feel free. It really is.
Hey, I'm in Canada.
Come on. This is tanning weather for us out here. The average person loves the book. It's the theologians that have a problem with it.
Yeah, it's true.
What did they have problems with?
this is so interesting. I had preached that sermon, okay, for the past 20-some years.
Thousand times. Now it's a big book, and everyone has a problem with it. Not everyone.
No. Only some religious leaders have a problem with it. And you know, at Dallas Seminary, I preached this my Dallas Seminary senior sermon and got an A on it. And then I'd preach it at seminaries and Bible colleges and the mega churches of the country. And do you know, in 25 years, not one person ever had anything negative to say. Not one person. And then it became the world's bestseller. And the next thing that happened is I'm reading these articles of critiques that I'm talking about prosperity gospel. And I'm saying to myself, get out of here. Right in the book, I say.
I remember that. It says this isn't about prosperity doctrine
gospel.
Stuff.
Or no. Whatever. Yeah. No. It shocked me. I was grieved. It was more than shock. I wasn't angry.
Have you heard of the tall poppy syndrome?
I don't think I have.
I lived in Australia for 5 years, and it's kind of a British thing. So anybody that rises above the crowd, they like to chop off the heads of them. And you rose up. You know, you had this big book. And you know, it's just like Rick Warren's gone through the same kind of stuff, right?
Yes.
You know. Blessings. Let's talk about the blessings, right? There's the knowing Jesus blessings. There's the rain blessings falling on everyone, right? Just and unjust. Then there's the ones that get the blessings you get from obeying God. Grace blessing. Or is that the first one?
You read Beyond Jabez.
Come on.
I'm impressed.
You say in the prayer of Jabez that if they pray this prayer repeatedly, it'll work, right? Even if you're living a life of sin, like you're just whole hog embracing sin.
You have any children?
Yeah, three. One of each.
That's a great answer. One of each. Let's say one of your children is really going through a rough time, and they're not doing what you want. And one night, they have no money or anything. They come over to you and say, "Dad, I'd love to have a pepperoni pizza. Will you order a pepperoni pizza?"
If they've been a jerk that week, I'd say no.
I don't know if you would or wouldn't.
Oh, it's called follow through and discipline and boundaries and all that kind of stuff.
Let's say you've already disciplined them.
Oh, okay.
They're just coming to you as dad.
Right.
You'd probably say yes. Well, did they deserve it? No. Why then would you do that? You do that because you just enjoy, as a dad, doing some dad things. I think God loves to give, but he loves the people to recognize where it came from.
Yeah.
So Jesus comes along and says, "I need to tell you a secret about my Father that you don't know about. There's some blessings he'll give to you if you live a certain way. And there's some discipline he'll give to you if you don't. And there's certain kinds of other blessings he'll give to you if you accept me as your Savior. They're spiritual blessings and they're in the heavenlies. And they're yours if you just believe. You can't behave a way to get them. You have to believe. And there's certain other kind of blessings that come just because he likes to give them. But he has a condition on these. You have to ask to be blessed and he'll give them." So here's what he said. I command you. It's an imperative in the Greek. I command you to ask, to seek, and to knock.
And keep on knocking.
Yes.
Keep on asking.
And my Father will give to you good gifts.
Even if you're living the life of a skanky hoe.
Yes.
Really.
What does it say? He loves to win people over by the goodness and by his compassions. It's not just always by his judgment. And sometimes, I remember this happened to my daughter one time. She got some terrible grades one semester, and she was expecting some kind of discipline or something. And she was so depressed. And she was expecting me to say something at dinner time. And I said, "Jennifer, did you really get these grades on your report card?" "Yeah, Dad." I said, "Sweetheart, you got it. This and this and this and this." "Yes." I said, "Well, get in the car right now." She said, "Get in the car? Get in the car." Well, the whole family was hearing my tone of voice, which wasn't very normal like that. So I said to everybody else, "Get in the car." We got in the car. Nobody talked. I drove over to the favorite ice cream place.
I knew you were going for ice cream.
And I said to her, "You know, sweetheart, I'm so glad you got this out of your system. Let's celebrate it's behind you." And that's all that was said.
What happens when she does it again?
She didn't.
Okay.
It's not always by punishment, is it? And somehow people have a hard time believing that God really is the Father of all of the human beings. Because Jesus said, how come if a son comes to dad and says, give me something to eat, he's not going to give him a rock. And then he says this, if you, being evil and compared to me, give, here's the words, good gifts, how much more will your heavenly Father give good gifts to you? A gift means you didn't earn it. And for it's, what's amazing to me is Jesus commands me to keep on asking for those kind of gifts. So I think when my children or grandkids come up to me and ask something totally independent of behavior, Dad, take us out for. That does something to me.
I get it. Folks, we are speaking with Dr. Bruce Wilkinson, author of many books. Unfortunately, he comes under the shadow of Prayer of Jabez all the time. Does that bother you? You're the Jabez guy?
You know, more and more now, it's the Dream Giver. It's interesting.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay, we'll talk about the Dream Giver in a bit. Let's get through this Jabez stuff. Keep me from evil. Different translations don't mean the same thing or didn't come across the same way. You took some heat for hunkering down into one translation as opposed to others.
Yeah, it's amazing how you can be criticized for using a Bible. Well, I chose a New King James Bible because I helped serve on the overview committee.
You're one of the guys that built that Bible.
And I wrote the outlines in the Open Bible.
Right.
So I liked it a lot. Well, that's a translation of a Hebrew word. And the Hebrew word may either mean pain or grief. It depends which context it's in. The people who believe it's grief, they believe it's a link to Jabez, which means pain. And so they say it should be interpreted as grief because it's a play on words for Jabez. Whereas I believe that's an acceptable way to translate it, but I believe it's that he's actually asking to keep you away from evil so that you may not experience the consequence of it. So both of them are acceptable translations, and we can't prove either one. And I believe I picked the better of the two.
Sure, yeah. You know, if you had taken this small verse and turned it into a large book, you would have taken, I think, even more heat. Thank God.
One pastor came to me and said, how come you did not put the Lord's Prayer in there? I said to him, sir, did you preach last Sunday? Yes. Did you include the Lord's Prayer? He said, well, no. I said, well, when's the last time you used the Lord's Prayer? He said, well, I haven't preached it in a while. I said, well, then why are you giving me a hard time? I'm not writing a book on the Lord's Prayer.
Was this small bite-sized book catering to a biblically illiterate culture? Is that one of the reasons you think it sold so well as well?
No, I don't. There's an awful lot of small books that don't sell. I honestly believe what happened, I do believe this, and I've been all over the world with this now, is that people prayed it, and then they got surprised. They did. I mean, I can't tell you the bags of mail I got and the stories. They got overwhelming, and I can't go anywhere.
Yeah.
And what people tell you isn't the size of the book. They tell you what happened when they prayed it. And there's something about a human being who's been praying for 20 years and sees maybe two or three real answers to prayer, and then they try this, and then God does something. They get enthused.
You know, one of the things I always have problems with is it was the prayer that worked, as though it was something disassociated with God. It was that prayer that worked, as opposed to, no, it was God that worked because you spoke to him clearly and concisely, and you trusted. There was a faith element here. You know what I mean? Is that just playing semantics?
No, it sure isn't. I remember the first interview I had. It was from Time. And the lady was anything but religiously inclined.
From Time? Come on.
And I said to her, I tell you what, would you take up a challenge? I've answered all of your questions as best as I can. Will you pray this prayer for 30 days and then write an article about what happened? And if nothing happened, would you put, I prayed the prayer of Jabez for 30 days and nothing happened, but if something happened, you have to tell the truth. And I said, will you pray it for 30 days? She said, no, I will not. She said, I'll meditate on it. I said to her, ma'am, meditating is good, but this isn't a meditation. This is actually a human being asking a God, to do something, actually four things. So the secret isn't the words, the secret of it working. This shocks people when I said, you pray it for 30 days and you'll see something happen. Jesus said in the New Testament, I want you to go into all the world and I want you to reach out, right? The prayer of Jabez says, Dear God, please let me expand my borders. Let me do more for you. Well, God commands you to do it in the New Testament, and here you are begging him to let you do what he commands you to do. And all four of those, you know, keep me from evil is the Lord's prayer. Lead us not into temptation. So you're begging God to do something he's already commanded you to do. That's why you get answers. You're saying, please let me do what you've commanded me to do.
I could have used you in Bible college.
Where did you go to Bible college?
Oh, I went to, what's it called? Ontario Bible College. Now it's called Tyndale. And I went to Morling Bible College in Sydney, Australia.
Good for you. When I was writing Beyond Jabez.
Yeah. You were thinking of cement heads like me struggling in Bible college?
No. But I was just thinking about the challenge with some of these things is people experience it and then they think it's past rather than realizing this is as long as you want and as big as you want. And I was editing Beyond Jabez, which is a lot more of the truth than I ever wrote in the little book. And I had to meet a deadline for Multnomah Press, and I was on the airplane to fly from Atlanta to L.A., and I had one flight to finish editing. I was in the final galleys, and I had upgraded. I had miles in my account, so I was in business class. And there was nobody sitting next to me. And I said, Lord, this is great. I can edit. So the door closes, and a guy walks in with spiked hair, different color hair, rings everywhere.
Sits right beside you.
And I'm saying, no, this guy will not sit next
to me. It's like a Tony Campolo story.
His stories are better than this. So this guy walks down, and he's already half drunk. And he drinks quite a bit. And we talk a little bit, and I look out the window, and I continue editing. And then I'm editing on Expand My Territory. And I read all these stories I had just written. And I said to myself, these stories aren't really true. I mean, just sitting and reading them again, even though I lived them, I said, this really didn't happen, did it? Because it's really miraculous when you read them. And then I said, Lord, don't be irritated with me. What would you do it one more time for me? And I said to him, I looked out the window on the jet, and I said, Lord, would you put the guy next to me in my territory? Would you, without me saying a word, do a miracle? Because that's what you're asking God to do. Not, I will enlarge my territory, which is fine to do, and I do those too. But you're asking him, will you enlarge it for me? Which means you experience the result of him enlarging it. I said, will you put him inside my circle and make him come my direction? So I then laugh a little bit. Here I am asking him again. So a few minutes go by, and he said, are you a priest? It's like this. And I said, am I a priest? And I right away put my hand up around my collar. But I have a collar on? I don't have a collar on. Why would he think I'm a priest? And I didn't know what to say. Am I a priest or not a priest? And I said,
did you get into the priesthood of all believers?
I said, I guess you could call me a priest. Why on earth are you calling me a priest? He says, I've been reading that blankety blank good book over your shoulder. I said, you've been reading the book? He says, yeah, while you're marking it. It's really good. Are you a priest? I said, well, I guess I'm a priest. Thank God. Thank God I'm a priest? Yes. He said, you've seen me drinking, haven't you? I said, sir, the whole plane has seen you get drinking. He said, that's because the best friend I had in the world was killed yesterday. He says, I'm flying out. I'm in charge of the Hollywood Bowl Rock concert. I'm the man in charge of all of it. And I woke up saying, if that had been me yesterday, where would I be? He said, I said to God this morning, God, send me a priest. And he said, you are the priest, aren't you? I said, yes, sir, I am. And I just had to tell God when that whole conversation finished, why do we ever miss the adventures that God has planned if we'll just ask?
Hmm. Wow. Dr. Bruce Wilkinson in the studio with us today, folks. The Dream Giver, another book that is creating waves. Here's a quote from you. God has this great dream and has this part of that dream where he says, I need someone to do point A to point B, and I'm going to make a person just specifically to do that. He takes that dream, puts it into the person's heart, and you call that the dream. So this is God's will or God's plan for our life? Is this what we're talking about?
God's will and God's plan has kind of a dry feel about it, doesn't it? It is to me.
It has a certain deep unfigure-outability.
Yeah, it does. It does. You know what? Why are you the way you are? Why are
drugs?
You drugs? But why do you love to question, and why do you love to go below the surface, and why do you like to go where everybody else may be afraid to ask, and why do you have that gift to keep it just humorous enough to keep it safe? Who gave you those gifts, and who put inside of you the desire to touch many people's lives at the same time? And who made it so that you would rather sit here by yourself and one other person than you would to be go standing out at the PK event talking? Maybe you would. I don't think so. Talking to all these people. Why do you feel innately like I can communicate to you through this little black thing right in front of my face? See, I believe God did all those things and you had nothing to do with them. Nothing. And that God wasn't kind of shocked when you came along saying, oh, here's a person who has these gifts and interests. I wonder what I'm going to do with this person. I wonder if I can invent something. I don't believe that that happened. And I don't believe that you came along and then God said, good luck. I hope you can find out what to do with you. Jeremiah has, before I formed you in the womb, Jeremiah chapter 1, I knew you. That's a shocking sentence to me. Before you were, I knew you. And before you were born, I picked you out and I ordained you to do something. Which means God, in my mind, had something he wanted done with this particular person, like all of us. And that's why you're here. It's not because your parents came together. It's because God wanted you here. And he wanted you precisely the way you are. And he wanted you to go through the struggles you went through in Australia and in other places. He wanted you to learn to become secure enough to ask difficult questions. He wanted you to care enough about people to open your heart on the radio. And he put all those things, and then he put what he wanted you to do inside of your heart. And he made it so big that initially you were probably overwhelmed by the thought of it. How on earth could I possibly do that? And I believe that's destiny. That's God's dream. And I believe that explains everything, not everything, but many things to do with who you are, were predetermined by God, good, bad, and ugly, to make you magnificent in fulfilling the destiny. And I find when I'm alone with somebody around the world, half the people will get very serious very quickly if you're talking about this part of their life. And half the people will tell you just about this sentence, I've never told anybody, but. And then they'll tell you the dream and they'll become emotional. And the other half will say, I don't have a dream. And I will say to them, yes, you do. You just maybe have been afraid to go look for them.
But what about the hokey dreams?
There are hokey dreams.
Thank you. I'm so glad you said it. Because if you were going to say there are no hokey dreams, you know, give me this sort of kumbaya answer, that doesn't work with me. I mean, I remember back at Christian camping, you know, and somebody unfortunately told this one girl, Melinda, that she could sing. And Melinda has been singing ever since. And people have been checking into hearing aid clinics. You know what I'm saying?
I do.
People feed other people lies and nonsense, and we all fool ourselves. We have that Jeremiah 17:9 heart thing happening, deceitful above all things, who can know it? And so I come up to you and go, you know, my dream, I want to just tell you real privately, you've got me excited with this mm-hmm. book, mm-hmm. is to be an astronaut. And I'm 6'4". Most astronauts aren't that tall because they don't fit in the stupid seats. And you got to go through a lot of school. I'm a high school dropout, grade 9. Mm-hmm. My retention is brutal. When I get older, the only thing I'll be retaining is water.
Well,
when do you shoot straight with someone and go, oh, come on?
It depends on how old they are and what they've been through and where they are in their journey and how beat up they are with how much of the full truth you want to tell them. Because ultimately, you want them to take another step in the right direction. I say we go through stages of a dream. We all start with a selfish dream. We all do. It's all about me. It's whether I'm going to be rich. My dream was to be a millionaire by the time I was 30, and I was on my way.
That was your dream?
Sure. That was most of my friend's dream.
Where'd you grow up? Connecticut?
Southern California.
Oh, same diff.
And as time goes on, then you start using people if that's the level of your dream. If it's all about you, then it's going to not be about others. Hmm. And hopefully you'll bump into other people and you begin to notice they have needs and they have dreams and they come in conflict with what your dream is. Because they want you to come on over and help them when you want to go sell a house or whatever you want to do. And therefore, my dream comes in conflict with your need, and I either take my dream and put it in second place and put your need in front of mine, and then I move to the second stage, which is our dream, kind of. My dream is kind of yours and mine. We'll do it together. And then as time goes on and you get older, you begin to realize that maybe your dreams shouldn't be so important. Maybe your dream should be what other people's dreams are. And you begin to live not for me, not for us, but for you. Where you put, as Philippians said, put other people's interests above yours. Oh, you got to die to some dreams. You got to die to your own internal wishes and fleshly desires.
See, I'm glad you explained that journey, because if you hadn't come to that later part where you sort of said it's not all about you, it's actually about others, you could very easily be lumped in with the Mind Body Spirit Festival folks in the self-actualization, and you know, if you think it'll happen, right? I mean, when I was playing ball and kicking a football, I mean, just visualize that ball going through the uprights, right? And just visualize it enough and it's going to happen. You think about something long enough, it's going to happen. Who you hang with is what you become, et cetera, the scripture that wraps around this stuff. So where it differs from the secular humanist or the New Age mindset is eventually you get to it's not about you.
It's not about you. And those people who really live that it's about you, not about yourself, are people that we respect greatly in our lives. They're the people that are unselfish and who attain acts of service that you respond to. Mm. But there is a fourth level. That's where you even go further than that, and you realize it's not only my dream, it's not our dream, it's not your dream, it's his dream. Mm. And when a person gets to the fact that they have died to their dream to live for his dream, you are a whole different other person. For you to get to that place means you have broken fingers. All your fingers have been broken off your dream. You can't hold them anymore. And Paul says, I have suffered the loss of everything, so that I could know you and the power of your resurrection. And Paul then lost his life to find what he was seeking after. And those are the people that I'm trying to help and find. Those people who realize there is a greater dream out there, and it's not yours, it's his. It's remarkable. It's wonderful.
Dr. Wilkinson, in thinking about this dream scenario and God's will and purpose and meaning in life, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Don't you think that God cares less about whether you're a baker, a plumber, or a beautician than what kind of a baker, plumber, and beautician you are? And how does that whole thing kind of segue, especially into those singles that are out there going, ooh, God's will for my life, man, you know, he's got someone picked out there for me. Man, if I don't pick the right one he picked, I'm going to be living with the wrong woman for the rest of my life. And that sucks. Mm-hmm. There's that whole, if I miss God's plan and will by one little iota, I'm screwed. I'm out of God's will. Don't you think God cares more about the kind of person you are than what vocation you're doing?
Maybe it's not either or. Because it's nice to make an either or. It's like the guys when I was growing up who said God doesn't care about quantity, he only cares about quality. And yet when you study what Jesus said, he said, you know, when I come back and I'm going to ask you, I gave you this many talents, how many did you give back to me? Mm. And the guy who doubled it gets the big thing, and the guy who just squandered it didn't get anything. Mm. God's very interested in quantity, not just quality.
So he's okay with mega churches and giga churches?
If you came to Christ and said, Jesus, I can talk to one person, I can talk to two people, I can talk to three people. I will be able to talk about the same topic in the same depth, but I can talk to one, two, or three. Which do you want me to talk to?
Maybe for a season, God wants you to shut up and talk to one. Yes. Maybe for another season, he wants it to be 10,000.
Yes.
Sorry, we're branching off to a few different rabbits here.
You said you had two questions.
Yeah, I got about nine now.
You just did.
Man.
I hit a hot button of yours.
Yeah.
Isn't it interesting that Christ seemed to draw huge crowds around him? What I'm trying to say is, don't make it either or. It's not quantity or quality.
Right.
And wherever somebody goes, all one or the other, they're off balance. The other one is, it's all character, and it's not your competence or your vocation.
No. I've never put up with that. I've seen too many incompetent Christians.
Okay. So it is character. It's also what you do. There are many, many men I was speaking to today that God wired them for greatness in an area, but because they wouldn't pay the price tag to go get to that area, they have compromised along the way, and something died inside of them.
Hmm.
They weren't meant to do that. And because they're not doing what they know they're meant to do, whatever that may be, something inside of a man just goes out. That's kind of a deadness that goes out. Just imagine if you couldn't do this anymore, and instead you had to not deal with people, but maybe a work doing something manually, let's say painting houses.
Oh.
Nothing wrong with painting houses.
Well, yes, there is.
But see, you just picked
a zinger there.
Yeah. You would die, wouldn't you?
I'd pay someone else.
Okay, but the guy who paints the house, who loves to paint, I have a good friend who's a great painter of houses. He'd pay anybody to do what you do.
Right.
So the challenge is for you to say it doesn't make any difference what you do isn't really true. It makes a big difference what you do. You have to do what he's wired you to do.
Okay, going into that, you know, what you're supposed to do kind of a thing. How many ticked off people are there working in factories going, are you kidding me? This is my life. I take part A and put it into part B. 8 hours a day. Well, 7 hours a day. Well, it's factory, so they probably work 6 hours a day. Because, I think there's so many people.
Some people love doing that.
Right. Some people do. But I think the majority of people are not going, ooh, man, my life is fulfilled, baby. This is awesome.
Well,
they're all sitting there going, in this North American dream, they're all sitting there going, I got to be something bigger. I got to do something better. I got to be, you know, write a book. I don't know. Whatever.
They don't have to work there if they don't want to. They've made a choice. And
but if somebody's got to do the grunt jobs. If we all got dreamy and wanted to be on TV.
Hold it now. What? Grunt jobs. When I write a book, to me, it's a grunt job. It is flat out hard work.
Right. And compared to digging post holes or throwing hay bales 24/7 or shingling a roof or, you know, shoeing horses.
But it all depends. A person who loves to shoe horses, that's you got to put it with how you've been made.
Right.
And if a person hates their job.
So I can't have any objectivity in this because I'm only seeing through my own filter, right?
What do you mean?
Well, like I'm looking at some of these jobs and going, oh, I would not want to make a life out of doing that job.
That's because you've been wired not to like it.
Right, so I don't have any objectivity in this because I can only see things the way I'm wired.
Yes, until you take God's viewpoint that says everybody's been wired differently.
Right.
And everybody loves to do certain things. It's when we don't believe that God wants us to do that which he made us to do. That our lives can really be ruined. They can be.
Hmm.
They can be wasted. And there are many men and women who have settled for that which God didn't make them to do. And they can blame everything they want, but ultimately, I'm responsible for my life, and so are they.
Hmm. Are you having fun? Are you enjoying the ride? Because it's been a weird one, man. I mean, all this bucks and fame and money and people knowing you, and has it been a ride?
Oh, it's been... My wife said to me, we've been married 37 years. She says, it's never been boring or dull one day in all of our marriage. And it still isn't. But, you know, I don't think God wants it to be.
Wants it to be what?
Boring and dull. And
see, this is where I go. Again, I get a rash of this stuff because it sounds too North American. It sounds like life should never be boring. We should all have rockin' jobs and dream our dreams. And I kind of go, really? Okay, so how does that work in Rice Paddyville?
Okay, I just lived in Africa for 3 years. So I lived and saw. Worse than Paddyville.
Yeah.
But there were people there in every context that rose above the circumstance that everybody else said was impossible. And they just did. I remember we... when we moved there and we saw all these people so hungry and yet saw all the ground everywhere. And I kept thinking, what's God's answer to hunger?
Plant something.
Yes. So we went back to Genesis. And he says, I've made this food for you to eat. It grows and it has its own seed. You don't have to buy the seed. I said, why aren't people growing their own food? Maybe they just lost track of it, or they lost hope. So we began to try and help people grow their own vegetables, because we found out what vegetables to grow, and we began to help. And then we said to people from here and in the U.S., come on over and let's work. I'm going someplace with this. So we would get some seedlings, because we found that people who had no hope gave up when the seeds didn't grow in a few days. So we decided to plant seedlings so they could see it, and they knew it was working. But in trying to give you an illustration of somebody who went above what everybody else was doing, there were four people, two from New York and two from someplace else, were carrying these bags of seedlings, and they came over the top of this extremely poor country, little valley, and there was down the bottom a mud hut with all these patches of ground all dug up, and there was kids everywhere running around, and they wondered, what on earth is going on? They go down into this valley, and there's a go-go, which is a African word for a grandmother.
Seriously?
Yeah, go-go.
Just gives whole new meaning to go-go dancer, doesn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
And they said, who are you? I'm a retired school teacher. My husband died of AIDS. Who are all these kids? Those are my kids. Those are your kids? What do you mean they're your kids? These are kids from around whose parents all died of AIDS, and they have no place to live. How many are there? There's 64. 64? Yes. How do you feed them? I don't know. God feeds them He feeds them. What are they doing here? Why are they digging with sticks in the ground? She says, because we had no more food and we had no more money. So last night, I said to God, God, these are your children. I cannot do this. Would you please send me somebody tomorrow to plant gardens? And this morning, she said, I got up and told the children, dig in the ground. God's going to send somebody to plant gardens. We came over from around the world.
You're freaking me out here with these stories, man.
A couple months later, I sent somebody back in. I said, find out about that old lady. They came back and they were quiet. Our guys were quiet. They were shaking their head, literally. And I said, what's the matter? We can't cope with what we saw. I said, oh, no, what happened? There's now 96 kids because of the food. She's able to take care of so many more kids.
Mm.
There's always people who realize that God has no limitations and that God will, if you're loyal to God, God will show his arm strong for you. It won't be easy. It's very difficult. I want to underscore that because I think you don't hear that at times. Maybe you've not heard that from me. It's extremely difficult.
What is difficult?
Living for God is extremely difficult. It's the hardest thing I've ever tried to do. I don't know of another thing that's harder. So in the midst of all of this, living your dream is extremely difficult. Unless you settle for a plateau. But if you follow through with what Jesus did, or even I read yesterday morning at the hotel. I was just praying. I was discouraged a bit, and I was praying about...
You were discouraged?
Sure. Life can be very hard. If you want to do more for God, you have to pay the prices of becoming a different person than you were, which means things have to change. So here he is writing in Corinthians. This is yesterday morning. And he says, even to the present hour, we both hunger and thirst, and we are poorly clothed, we are beaten, and we are homeless. I was just thinking. And, you know, last Saturday, I was in Portland, Oregon, speaking at the biggest homeless work in Portland. And I met a bunch of guys and girls who were homeless. I thought to myself, 5 days later, that was one of the men I respect most in history, beaten, hungry, and homeless. and some of the trauma of my own life then. It is the realization that God says to you, if you want to really keep your life, you're going to have to lose it. Hmm. And he says, unless you hate your life in this world, you will lose it. I don't mean die. I mean there is a place in which you are to come as a mature man or woman of God, not a young one, a mature one, in which you come to the place in which you actually hate your life in this world. So I have come that place.
Did what happened in Africa help you get there? Because I think you've said that it wasn't necessarily a success. I think you actually used the word failure.
No, I never used that word.
No?
No.
The Wall Street Journal did a brutal job reporting on that whole thing?
They did. I've learned such a... And all the people in the media who are believers and have experienced this, we all have commented together that the media is...
vicious?
Can be totally irresponsible. They can write what they want, and they can spin what they want, and you're helpless to do whatever... you're helpless. I remember interviewing for USA Today for 2.5 hours. And then in the next couple of days, it came out, and they quoted 3 words. And they wrote about things that had nothing to do with what I said. Mm.
Larry Norman, famous line from him. They quote me perfectly and then rewrite every word I speak.
Yeah, the Wall Street Journal was extremely... they had their own agenda.
Did you want to sue them?
No.
Because we're okay to sue people who aren't Jesus people.
It's interesting. God says, vengeance is mine, and I will repay, he said. So I believe him.
In the 40-page Dream for Africa plan, Wilkinson sought a 99-year lease on the land and control of nearby game parks from the King of Swaziland. Wilkinson gave the king just 5 days to approve the plan, which was refused. Soon thereafter, Swazi newspapers published details of the Dream for Africa draft plan, which turned public opinion against Wilkinson. According to the Wall Street Journal article, when the Swazi king failed to meet with him again in what was perceived as a snub on behalf of the king, Wilkinson decided to depart, stating publicly that his job was done and that God wanted him to leave Africa, but he informed his inner circle that he was done with Swaziland, done with Africa, and done with the Dream for Africa. Your response?
None of that sentence is true. None of it is true.
First of all, the king.
Yes.
Was he a fairly interesting fellow? I read stuff like he had, there was a law that said you couldn't have sex, or you couldn't get married before 18, and then he wanted to get marry some 17-year-old, so he changed the law. And then, of course, he's a polygamist, so he's got a lot of wives who are very young, and then he had some big party where they're all dancing topless. Is this the kind of guy we're talking about?
It's a different culture.
Right.
Yeah, but wait a minute now. It really is a different
yeah,
culture.
Yeah, yeah. So dance, that's what I thought. Dance atop. I mean, I saw the National Geographic movies when I was growing up, and that was my first porn, you know.
You know, I came to Swaziland because years ago I began to pray for Swaziland. I went out and bought a globe on a stand. It was about a foot and a half or round. More than that, maybe 2 feet around. And every morning when I would pray, I would hold the globe in my hand, in my arms. And I would ask God to put his burden for the world inside of my heart. And I would turn it, and then I would pray for the countries. And I would begin to ask him, lay a country on my heart that you want me to have on my heart. And it came to be Swaziland, which I'd never heard of. And a lot of things happened that I don't really have time to tell you about. But I eventually ended up there in Swaziland, helping. Number one AIDS nation in the world is Swaziland. Used to be Botswana. Now it's Swaziland. And it's run by a king. And I'm a person who believes that God's answer works, number one. And if something doesn't work, it's not God's answer, or it's God's answer implemented incorrectly. And that God's answer is scalable, which means you can roll out his answer all across Africa once you find it and work it out. So we began to try to deal with the biggest problems we saw. And the first thing we dealt with was hunger, about planting. We called them never-ending gardens because you could seed them and then plant again. And We tested it out, had the national agencies help us about what to plant, work with the Department of Agriculture in these countries, et cetera, and brought down volunteers. And they would plant tens of thousands of gardens for people who had no food. So amazing things happen. And in the last year I worked there, we planted 400,000 backyard gardens. Just think about that number. At the same time, we identified AIDS as a big problem. And so in the second year, we began to deal with what can we deal to help with AIDS. And I went to meet with a man in charge of AIDS in Swaziland, Derek von Wissel. I said, Derek, what's the number one strategic place to focus on with AIDS in Swaziland? He said, well, the high school kids. Once they get out, we lose them and they get infected. I said, okay. So when I was meeting with the president of Kenya, I asked him earlier, what can I do to help him? And he asked me to make a Hollywood movie.
This is Beat the Drum?
Yes. I don't really want to get into that. But we made a Hollywood movie in Africa about a Zulu boy whose parents are dying, who died of AIDS, and what happens to him. And we put 20 misconceptions in the movie. It's now in 172 countries. It's won 29 awards.
Mm-hmm.
And I backed away from that publicly just because God's directing my life in a different direction now. And other people are leading it. So we then showed it to the parliament. And they said, oh, everybody in our country should see this. And I realized God's given us a tool here. And so I got some college and university kids together, and we made a curriculum on this. When I came back to the States, I was speaking at a university in the United States. And on the way to go speak, I asked the president of the university, would you mind if I changed my topic and asked your students to come to Swaziland? He said, what? We talked. He said, yes, I did. And the next year, we had 1,000 university students from 11 countries go. And we trained them in a week-long curriculum. We divided them up into multicultural teams of 10. And we spent a week in every high school campus, every high school campus in the entire country of Swaziland, where there were college kids. You know how high school kids look up to college kids, talking about AIDS and about abstinence and about you can wait and safe sex and other things, and about how to stop people raping you. Because it was happening everywhere.
Yeah.
There was a huge transition in the country, and everybody saw it. There were statistics that validated it.
So you made an impact with food. You made an impact with you made an impact on hunger. You made an impact on AIDS.
And then I had four. We identified the four top goals and needs.
Employment.
The first one was hunger. The second one was AIDS. The third was poverty, which had to do with employment. And the fourth one had to do with orphans. And I have a standard approach. Identify the need, see how large it is, find God's answer to it, test it, revise it, retest it, revise it, roll it out. So we started with hunger, followed that, and it was flying big time. Then we then moved to AIDS, and it was flying big time. In fact, we were asked by presidents of countries to come to all their schools because it was getting around what was happening. And then I was working on two other things. We were working on poverty and orphans. And this is what I told the interview with the Wall Street Journal. I said, this is the testing of a concept. I said, I've not hired one person. Every dollar we've spent on this has been from our personal pocket. This is a test of a concept with the orphans. I don't know if this will work. We have to test it. Revise it, test it, revise it, and roll it out. I said, I don't know if this will work. We got an invitation from the president of one country in Africa. He was giving us 25,000 acres if we'd come do the strategy of the orphans in his country. But because I started first with Swaziland, I wanted to honor the king and the nation and offer them first. So for a year and a half, I was working on the idea. A year and a half. And had numerous meetings with the Prime Minister, with various members. I met with all members of the cabinet. I spoke to the parliament. And there's a long story here. But all that happened was, at the end, for political reasons I shouldn't discuss, the leadership of the country made a decision. And with their decision, I said to myself, this is the wrong country to do this in.
I know you can't discuss it, but can you at least explain why you can't discuss it?
Because it would create tension where it's not going to help anyone to create it.
Tension over there in Africa, or tension with people here in North America, people in ministry, other big people that are famous that you work with?
Isn't it nice to be nebulous? We had told the king, I'd met with the king. The king had approved the concept. So had the prime minister.
Yeah.
So it wasn't a matter of the king.
So the five-day thing was a load of garbage.
Very much so.
Because they say that your response was, look, they knew about it. They've known about it for a long time. Was there a deadline that came and went?
There were numerous deadlines that came and went.
Okay.
Because I kept saying to the prime minister, who the king put in charge of this, he says, make this a high priority and get this done. I got a call at 10:30 at night from the prime minister one night. He said, I had an emergency call from the king. I just been there with the king. And the king says, tomorrow morning at 7, I'm to meet with you, with the Minister of Employment and Enterprise, to talk about the project. He wants it working. So he called me at 11 o'clock at night. And next morning at 7 o'clock, that's what we're talking about. Some things happened that had nothing to do with me. Hmm. That happened that changed that. It had nothing to do with the project. So I kept telling them, because they had 6,500 in a small country, 6,500 huts that they were orphan led, meaning the oldest child was 13. They had an average of 5 children in the hut. Hmm. No parents. They're all dead. The amount of trauma that happens inside of one of those is, I don't want to ever talk about it publicly. So they were, as a country, just folding under this, because the percentage of infection was not turning around. And still, in Africa, it hasn't turned around, no matter what
Clinton says.
Just look at the numbers. So I said to them, I need ramp-up time. I need to build the first African Dream Village home for an African couple and their kids, for 2 grandparents, for 5 boys and 5 girls on 10 acres, fenced with animals, with food they grew. We know how to do all this. But I said, we have to build a prototype and get the people in the country to agree to this. Then we have to refine it, rebuild it. Then I have to recruit the people from America to come in and build it. And I said, every time we postpone something, we're 6 months later from starting it. So I would be going back to the States every 3 or 4 months to recruit. And I would be telling them, I'm going back. I can either recruit or I can't. It's up to you. And they kept getting into political challenges. So it wasn't 5 days. It was over a year of time. And a decision was reached that was not directly about what I wanted to do. It was an alternative area that made me realize this isn't going to happen in Swaziland.
So you said bye-bye.
Well, no. I'd signed a lease on a house in Swaziland for a year and came back to America and was determined to go back, because there was many things happening. The head of the $15 billion fund in our country of U.S. had been down there and saw what we're doing, and they said, you actually have a plan that's going to finish the hunger thing. When they start growing it and regrowing it, and we don't have to keep sending emergency aid. That's right. And we had a problem. The solution we had worked up regarding
this story is killing me for a couple of reasons. One, there's details that just fog me. Two,
understand.
Well, no, but it's you know, there's a lot of details in here that, from an outsider living in Canada, I just don't give a holy grunt about. Right. Yep. Well, what I'm hearing from you, Bruce, is answers to starvation, hunger, AIDS, all sorts of things are doable, that you are about to do it. And for whatever reason, didn't happen.
No, we were doing it with hunger.
You were on the way to eliminating some major issues.
Maybe the word is, we were rolling out to the next level answers that were working.
Yeah. So it was
good. Not all of them were working. Obviously, right. Some people wouldn't grow the food. Sometimes the goats would get it. Sometimes the water would get it. But there was a large enough percentage.
Okay. But my point is, are you not stinking frustrated about the whole Africa thing?
I was heartbroken.
Yeah.
I was heartbroken because I wanted to go back. And we weren't expecting to go to Africa in the first place. I was going to Hollywood to make movies to impact more people.
Yeah, this came out of Hugging the Globe.
It did, and it came out of God surprisingly asked us to go. And we signed a lease on a home in Swaziland, came back here, and as surprised we were as a family to go, we were surprised by the Lord saying, what I want you to do, you've finished. You've handed it off to other people. In fact, we handed off this movement to two Canadians, Ian and Janine Maxwell, who used to live in Toronto.
Oh, I saw the picture of them. She's blonde?
Yes.
Yes.
At the largest marketing firm in Canada. Now they're heading it up. And I trained them for 6 months before I left. And we were planning on moving back. And, it's a personal issue how God leads people. Hmm. And God was very clear to us. I don't want you going back. We wrestled with it and argued it for months, and then we eventually said, okay. So the whole story of Wall Street was a man who had an agenda.
What an article. I mean, look how long it is.
I know.
They spend a lot of time trying to smack you upside the head.
And put it on the front page. And if you read through that, you're not going to find out of all the things that we did with the food and with the AIDS.
No, you can you can smell slant in it. It's a no-brainer.
I said to the man, remember, this is a concept that we're trying to develop in our mind.
Yeah.
We've not launched it. We've not spent $1 on it. And he attacked on the front page of Wall Street Journal an idea.
Hmm. Nice. The American way. Truth, justice. You're a Jersey boy, eh?
Yes, born in New Jersey.
David, Jennifer, Jessica. Is Jessica out yet?
She's in college.
So she's gone now.
She's a junior in college.
Empty nester?
Yes.
You feeling good about that? Cosby says you should sell your home, move into a one-bedroom apartment so they don't come back.
Well, we got 6 grandkids, so we like them coming back from time to time.
Andrew, Eric, Johnny, Jonathan. Who are the other ones?
Kobe. And the little princess, we call her.
The little princess.
Yes.
Who would be?
Catherine. She's the 6th one.
One amongst all the boys.
Yes, and she's a princess.
Does she melt you?
Yes.
Anything you want to give her, you just give her.
Yes, more than.
Prayer of Jabez, shield, the whole thing.
Yes.
You have been an absolute pleasure to speak with. Founder and president of Walk Through the Bible Ministries back in 1976. World Teach. Global initiative, develop a Bible teacher for every 50,000 people in every nation of the world.
Do you know what happened with that? In the first 5 years, this was such a great lesson.
You exceeded numbers.
We opened a new country of the world every 13 working days.
Mathematically, it was pretty much impossible.
It was. But just think about what I just said. A new country every 13 working days for 5 years in a row.
That's weird.
At the end of 5 years, we had more than 80 countries from scratch. And of the 30,000 teachers, less than 20 of them were Americans. When you actually ask the question, what does God want done? And then commit yourself without the sin of unbelief to go do what he wants done, believing he will come through for you.
Giddy up.
The book of Acts is continuing to be written.
You still working in Hollywood? Working on a motion picture?
It's very difficult.
Difficult to answer? Difficult?
It's very difficult to do.
But are you still working in Hollywood?
Yes.
On a major motion picture?
Yes. We made one.
Yeah.
We're on a second one.
Is it going to be another, like, beat the drum kind of thing or something else?
No, much bigger.
Really?
If we can ever get there. It's got challenges.
Oh, yeah.
We had an Academy Award winning writer write it, the script. And we are just in the challenges of the process that Hollywood can cause you to go through. If I'd have known how hard it would have been, I don't know if I would have tried.
You'd gone back to writing. That was a lot easier. Right? Who kicked in the guts more, the Wall Street Journal or MacArthur's response to your book? Because he put it's still on his website. There's a bit of I'm not too impressed with the Prairie Jabez stuff.
You know, if you're continuing to pray, please make me more like Christ. A lot more. Not a little, but a lot more. He'll answer your prayer. And the way he'll do it is not ways you appreciate at the time. And I guess I needed to be nationally humbled with the article. So I was.
With the Wall Street article?
Yes. Be it true or false. And it did. It was humbling, even though I knew and my family knew that's not at all what happened. It was humbling. Because when you move to Africa, nobody sends you to Africa. We moved because we wanted to. We went with no one. We went with no organization. We funded with all the money we had. And your motive was so to help. To get beat up so hard on the other side.
That's a kick in the gut.
It is. But you know what? That was not outside of what God wanted. And therefore you receive it. And you, hopefully your heart becomes tenderer through it. And you realize that you live for either the applause of heaven or you don't.
That article pales in comparison in huge ways to the whole Ted Haggard thing. There's certainly apples and oranges, but there's a relatability in that you've got the media attacking and spinning and doing whatever. And in his case, apparently there's some truth because he's admitted to it in the official statement.
But you know, my heart broke for him.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, who above among us cannot, who can throw the first rock? Not in any way excusing anything of any of us. But boy, the older I have been and the more I've lived and the more I've stumbled and the more I've helped other people who have stumbled around the world, the more you realize how sad that is for them as a couple, as a family, for himself, for God, for the kingdom, for our country. But never anything except, you know, Lord, please have mercy, show compassion.
He and many others have been accused of not being accountable enough. And someone said to me recently, look, you want to get around accountability, you can always get around accountability. You can have all the accountability stuff set up in your life. You can get around it. But having said that, do you think all big kahunas like you, Ted Haggard, Billy Graham, I don't know, whoever else you want to put in that category, who've kind of come to the top of the heap, you think you should be traveling alone at all, ever? That's the whole, you know, that's the solution a lot of people say. You should never travel alone.
Isn't it interesting that Jesus traveled alone in the New Testament actually says that? And he by himself went to Jerusalem. His disciples went ahead of him.
So would you recommend that? If you were pastoring a church, you had other little pastors around you, would you say to them, hey guys, if you're going to go speak here and here and here and here, make sure you're traveling with someone?
Would I say that?
Yeah.
If a person has trouble with pornography in his room, or if he has trouble with women or men on the road, I would say you should do whatever you need to do to cope with your temptations.
But that comes down to being able to be vulnerable enough in the Christian church, in Christendom. And I feel so brutal for, matter of fact, when we say goodbye to you, which thank you for your time, I've got to let you have a life here again. We're going to open up our phones to callers here in just a couple of minutes, folks. We're going to be asking you this question. Do you feel sorry for Ted Haggard, or are you angry about yet another high-profile pastor's secret life of sin? Because there's a lot of different reactions out there. When I think this through, and again, we're speaking with Dr. Bruce Wilkinson here. When I think it through, Bruce, I just curl up in agony for this guy because I think the least safest place for him to be open and honest about his struggles is the industry that he's a part of. And I mean industry, you can cross over any way you want. He can't talk to his wife about that. If he struggled with drugs, you could talk about that. Maybe even if he struggled with lust or pornography or maybe, you know, hookers or something, maybe you could talk with that. But it's harder, I think. I think this homosexuality thing, if you're struggling with that,
it's very difficult.
You don't want to come out with this stuff, especially in the Jesus kingdom. So this guy was trapped and alone. That's why I feel so bad for him. When I was pastoring for 5 years, it was one of the loneliest things going when it came to vulnerability.
Mm-hmm.
Because if I confess, as we all struggle, then I would lose my job. I would lose my house because it was tied in with a job. You know, we're in another country. You know, there's just so many things. Wow. And that, and my scenario pales, as I said, in comparison.
And see, the more vocal or public the person becomes in a given area, the more the enemy does set you up. Not that you're still not responsible for your actions, because you are, but you have more flack. When I worked in Russia for 5 years, my goodness, the enemy was brutal.
On you?
Yes.
So he was wailing on you?
Yes. Whenever you're the leader of a particular area, especially if you're on the front edge or the front line, you will get all kinds of. But, and I'm sure Ted did as well.
Bruce, if we were in anything else in the world, I would venture to say any other scene in the world, community, we could talk real openly about this. I could sit here and say, Bruce Wilkinson, you just said in Russia you struggled big time because the enemy was wailing on you big time.
Mm-hmm.
What did you struggle with? And we could have a beautiful, open conversation about that. But in the kingdom of God, on this planet, that's a no-fly zone.
I would say that's probably pretty true. But I would tell you what it was. I mean, it's not an issue. Because for me, it wasn't in Russia, it was, well, I'll get into areas here that people won't be able to identify with. I talked to a major producer who was a part of the Passion movie. I won't tell you his name. There's more than one, obviously. And we were talking at length about this because I was talking to him about the movie that I'm working on. And he said in the middle of it, it was so thick and the attacks were so brutal at night at 3 o'clock in the morning. He said, I'd have to sleep with a crucifix on my chest. And then I began to tell him things about
Russia.
Yeah. And he started weeping right there in front of about five other directors and producers. He said, I've never had anybody who understood. I said, I understand fully what you're talking about. So I think we don't always know, and it's easy to judge, but if you haven't been there, be careful.
Oh, exactly. Exactly. Well, I guess we've got to say goodbye. It's a sad thing, but I have appreciated your time.
You have a real ministry here.
I got something.
Yeah, but you do. I like your spark in your eye, and I like the heart in you a lot. And I want to just thank you, honestly. Keep it up.
Well, thanks.
And reach in for the people's hearts more, maybe.
Trying.
Okay.
Trying. Dr. Bruce Wilkinson, who is known as the author of many books, Prayer of Jabez just being one of them. Pray for the guy, will you? Might be a good thing to do. A short break on the show. When we come back, taking your calls, folks, 905-338-1250. Do you feel sorry for Ted Haggard? Or are you angry about yet another high-profile pastor's secret life of sin? It's a big story. And then later in the show, General Romeo Dallaire, who, of course, led the UN peacekeeping mission in Rwanda during the genocide when approximately 800,000 men, women, and children were brutally killed. Unbelievable story from Romeo Dallaire. We'll be right back.
Like what you've heard? Listen again online at drewmarshall.ca.